This is Radio Times. I'm Artie Moscoane. Buddy Miley's dead body was found in a room in a motel outside of Detroit in March 1997. He had wanted to commit suicide and had enlisted the help of Dr. Jack Kevorkian. Miley had been a star quarterback who played for Tennant High School in the Philadelphia suburbs until a paralyzing injury dashed his dreams and changed his life and the life of his family. Buddy's brother Jimmy and Jimmy's girlfriend had flown with him for his appointment with Kevorkian. Our guest Mark Cram Jr. begins his book about the sad story with Jimmy and his girlfriend flying back to Philadelphia, not knowing about Buddy's last moments. Cram's book is called Like Any Normal Day. He's a senior writer at the Philadelphia Daily News, and he joins us on Radio Times. And Mark Cram, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks, Marty.
This story begins actually in 1973, or I guess in many ways, this is the accident that paralyzed Buddy Miley. He was a quarterback for this high school. Sounded like a pretty talented guy, a lot of personality. Take us back to that game in 1973.
Well, he was, I think every town in America has a Buddy Miley. He's not probably going to play pro ball one day. At some point, he'll reach his limit as an athlete. But at that time, he was certainly the big man on campus. You know, the girls loved him.
Good-looking guy.
The guys admired him and envied him. Good-looking guy. A lot of personality. He was all that stopped in one split second of horror on a play that happens in every game, on every play. It was a clean hit, but it was a devastating one. It was like he was a surfer that was kind of trapped inside a collapsing wave. In that split second, it was as if his body was unplugged.
He describes, or you certainly describe in this book, this kind of sizzling noise, I guess, when his neck snapped.
That's correct. It's hard to say because, you know, we're talking about in the 70s a dark time when it comes to safety precautions. You know, he had this injury, and the situation was such that, you know, his teammates lifted him up off the ground and placed him on the stretcher. That would never happen today. It was a situation where he was jostled. His helmet was taken off. I mean, everything that that could have been done wrong. That would never be done today. He'd been stabilized today. He'd be just treated with far more care. But that was a different time then. It was a dark time.
Well, in fact, you write when he was taken to the hospital, they thought he had a broken leg and not a broken neck.
That's right, because one of the other player on the opposing team had broken his leg, and they called ahead. That player told me that he overheard the driver call ahead to the hospital. We have two players with a broken leg. And Bert Miley, Buddy's father, said he has more than a broken leg, he was telling the attendant. Mm-hmm. So there was a bit of confusion surrounded. There was panic. And, you know, there's always going to be panic when these sorts of situations happen. No one is to blame. It's just the way it unfolded.
What were the extent then of his injuries? I mean, he became a quadriplegic, but in terms of his disabilities or even abilities, what could he and couldn't he do?
Well, he's paralyzed from the neck down. He had some ambient movement in his arm. Couldn't do much with his with anything below his body. But he had a mind that worked. That was as sharp as a tack, and he had a huge heart. That he shared with anyone that came and sat down with him and spent some time with him. And that was the interesting part of this. When I met him, I was struck by his honesty about his situation. And, you know, it was as if he were saying, "You want to know what this is like? I'll tell you exactly what it's like. The pain is absolutely horrible. It's searing. It's like it comes over me in spasms, as if I were shot with a taser gun. you know, it would leave him gritting his teeth. Do you want to know what it's like? It's the longing that you feel, the needs that you have. He was a it's the friends that once used to pile into the house and sit around your bed who weren't there anymore. And that's what kind of attracted me to this story, because we see these injuries all the time, don't we? And then we wonder what happened to these people.
They kind of disappear.
They disappear. They absolutely disappear.
Papers.
So what I wanted to do is take this thread and pull it out and see how far it led. And what I found was that this story was not just about Buddy Miley, but is about all the lives that intersected with his.
Well, let me pick up on that, because he had a large family. They were determined to keep him at home. He had what sounds like a fierce mother who was determined to take care of her son and siblings that came in and helped, some more than others. But nonetheless, they built an addition onto the house so that Buddy could live at home.
Right. And what we see in this situation, I mean, it's sort of like the gold that we find in the darkness, the horrible injury. But within that, we see unbelievable charitable efforts on behalf of just people in the community that came forth and built this addition onto the side of the house. The family was extraordinary. Rosemary Miley was the quintessence of motherhood in many ways. Brothers and sisters all pitched in and did what they could. So it was, they really, so lots of lives intersected with it.
You actually met Buddy Miles. This goes back to 1993. This was your first meeting with him, and his mother had written a letter to Sports Illustrated, and out of that, this meeting was set up where you met Buddy. You include this letter that Rosemary Miley wrote, and I wonder if you could read.
Right, I have it here.
You have it here.
Right,
I'll
read one paragraph.
Go ahead.
My son broke his neck 19 years ago playing high school football. Since then, our home has been a hell on earth. The injury has altered forever the life of our family and the lives of our son's friends. I'm sure the majority of SI readers love football. I asked them to spend one day with my son. They will see the terrible pain he endures. They will feel his frustration at being totally dependent on others. Now, it goes on, but, you know, this sort of is the... This really caught my attention.
Sure. And you went to the house, you went and you spent those 4 hours with Buddy.
I did. I called her. I called Rosemary and I asked to come out, and she graciously invited me out to spend some time with Buddy. Buddy enjoyed the company. And he, was glad to talk about it. He wasn't bitter. You know, I think, you know, no one is spared suffering in life, you know. You can be either embittered by it or ennobled by it. And I think Buddy was indeed ennobled by it, you know. I got that sense. So I spent this time with him, and I thought, you know, this is an extraordinary guy.
Yeah. I found it interesting, and maybe this tells us a lot about Buddy Miles, which is which is that he showed you the footage of his injury.
He did.
Do you think he wanted to see your reaction, how did you... What did you think he was telling you by doing
well,
that?
Well, I think he did this with many new visitors. I think he was sort of showing it as much for himself as he was for me. I think he always looked at it with a degree of curiosity as far as sort of what happened, where did it go wrong, where was the kind of the crack in the earth that he had fallen into, and. But he was very matter of fact and open about his situation.
You wrote a piece. This goes back a number of years, but you wrote a piece in the Philadelphia Daily News about Buddy. 19 Years of Hell was the title of
it. That's right. It came out on his 37th birthday, and it was 19 years of hell. You know, Richard Ford in one of the endorsements for the books talks about it being a cautionary tale. And, indeed it is. I would think if you have a son that plays football, this book would scare the hell out of you.
Because because of the extent of the injury. A typical play.
But it's beyond that, too. I mean, what happened to Buddy is an extreme example right. of what can happen. But we've seen in news reports over the last few years what some of the longer lasting after effects of football, you know, the brain injuries that occur. You know, just last week, a former Atlantic Falcons player committed suicide, and the idea, the sense is that he probably had some serious brain damage. So, you know, the whole essence of football goes back to what George Halas, the great owner of the Chicago Bears, once said: a good player becomes less good the harder you hit him.
Mm.
And now, however hard you try to clean up football, that is always going to be the essence of this sport.
We're going to be meeting Buddy Miley's brother, Jimmy, in just a couple of minutes. Your book actually begins with Jimmy and his girlfriend. They're flying back from Detroit to Philadelphia. They have taken Buddy to Dr. Jack Kevorkian because he wants to
yeah.
commit suicide.
I know. It was they had gone out there under the cloak of secrecy.
Right.
Rosemary Miley was under the presumption that they were that Jimmy was taking Buddy to an eye doctor appointment in Center City. She put a peanut butter sandwich in Buddy's pocket, you know, to eat later. And and yet they were going out to Michigan to for an appointment with Kevorkian, because Buddy just couldn't take it anymore.
And we'll find out more from Jimmy Miley. But the way you write about it, it sounds like this is something that Buddy Miley had thought about for some time. This was not an impulsive thing. He was in pain, and it sounds like he just didn't want to live anymore, didn't want to live his life anymore.
Well, I think that, of course, he was in pain. He was in awful pain, unendurable pain. I defy anyone who questions what he did to spend one day in his shoes, in that bed. You know, the seconds building to minutes, the minutes building to hours, the hours building to weeks, the weeks building to months, the months building to years. Almost 25 years. And So he did that, but he also looked at his mother, who was fading. You know, she carried the load of caring for Buddy, and did so happily, graciously. She would still be doing it today, but I think Buddy, you know, wanted her to have some quality years in her future.
We're going to take a very short break, get back to our conversation with Mark Cram Jr. We're talking about his new book, Like Any Normal Day, A Story of Devotion. It's about Buddy Miley, who committed suicide actually in 1997. His brother, Jimmy Miley, waiting in the wings. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Hello, this is Margaret Kuo. Sunday, April 29th, I'll host a Madame Butterfly dinner. Miss Butter, formerly of New York City Opera, will perform selections from Puccini's masterpiece and traditional Japanese numbers. Margaret Kuo, support WHYY.
I'm Marty Moscowane. We're about halfway through the spring membership campaign here at WHYY. At least we hope so. We will make our goal and reach it on time if you do your part and become a member, a supporter of WHYY. Think of all the programs and services that you enjoy. News and information around the clock on the radio, events here at WHYY, and engaging and involving social media at WHYY.org. Surely that's worth your pledge of support. Pick up the phone and call 1-888-345-9499, or you can pledge online at WHYY.org. We produce almost 500 live, hour-long interviews every year on Radio Times. It's a handmade show that the producers and I put together every day. We keep you informed about local, national, and international news, provide commentary and analysis, and introduce you to interesting people and ideas. 1-888-345-9499. Thanks for that pledge.
Programming is supported by 21st Century Cyber Charter School. providing public online education for grades 6 through 12, utilizing the latest information and communication technology. More information at 21stcenturycyber.org.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. We're talking about Buddy Miley. He was a star quarterback at Tennant High School just outside of Philadelphia. His teenage dreams were dashed while playing a game in the fall of 1973. He was injured, paralyzed, lived with his parents, and for a while had hoped for a cure. But in March 1997, he flew with his brother to a nondescript motel near Detroit where Dr. Jack Kevorkian administered drugs that ended Buddy's life. It is what he said he wanted. Mark Cram tells a story in his book, Like Any Normal Day. He's a senior writer at the Philadelphia Daily News. And joining us on Radio Times is Buddy Miley's brother, Jimmy Miley. And Jimmy, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Good. Thank you, Marty.
Have you read the book?
Yeah, I did read it. I went through it, and some spots I had to flick the pages. It's an emotional story.
Well, I don't know you, and I didn't know your brother, and I read the book as well, and I found it emotional as well. And it must be a challenge for you because this has been a very private story.
Yeah.
And now, you know, people like me, strangers, are starting to read about your family.
Yeah. Well, what's interesting, I was listening to the show, and tears are welling up in me. And I was always brought up not to cry and stuff, and all of a sudden I'm welling up like a baby a lot lately.
Yeah. Well, so, I mean, do you feel like you're reliving some of this?
Well, there was things that I did, like the football field, the injury. Like we're really getting in details in it, and I wasn't there that day, so I go back and it reminds me of the nightmare days.
And, Jimmy, the way Mark Cram writes about you and your brother, Buddy, I mean, you sound like you were younger, he was older.
Right.
Both athletic, but it sounds like you two were so close.
Yeah, well, I always think he was my brain and I was his legs. Uh-huh. And, yeah, we were very close. He wouldn't do me wrong and I wouldn't do him wrong ever.
If this is too painful, I apologize for this. But I'm curious about when he talked to you about his idea of ending his life, of killing himself. What did he say?
Well, it wasn't just a one day. All of a sudden, oh, I want to die. I don't think he liked it from day one when he got hurt that day. He just never liked being paralyzed.
Yeah.
And so actually, he used to say a lot. Before he went to bed, I hope God takes me in my sleep tonight. You know, he wanted to die of a heart attack.
Do you think he was depressed?
No, he wasn't depressed. He was quad. He couldn't feed himself. He would get bed sores, and it was reality. I don't think it was depression. It was reality.
Let me get to Mark. Let me get you back in on the conversation because
sure.
You had talked to an interview buddy. You've done the same with Jimmy. How did you see their relationship?
Well, I think the cover on the book says it all. Two boys in little league uniforms on a sunny day on their way to the ball field. It really speaks of the bond that they had. I didn't have a big brother, but I can certainly see the absolute the love that existed between them.
Jimmy, going back to you, and it sounded like for a while, Buddy and maybe even your family thinking there might be a cure out there for him. You even took him to Lourdes.
Correct. We did France. That. Alan Amici, the former Alan Amici, he donated some money for me and Buddy to get a miracle in France. And yeah, we tried everything. We believed, we prayed, we tried everything for years and years. And then finally, I think he was like, oh, I don't think nothing's working, you know? So, I forget what you even asked.
Oh, that's okay. No, I was thinking. Well, and I'm just actually, let me go back to Mark because you describe Buddy and Jimmy going to Lourdes,
right.
Obviously based on interviews that you did. But can you describe? And it sounds like Buddy was dropped in a very cold tub of water.
Yes, yes. he wanted Jimmy to take him into the tub.
Yeah.
In fact, he said, "Where's my brother?" You know. So the attendant had to hand him over back to Jimmy. I think it was for Buddy the ultimate Hail Mary pass, to use the parlance of the sport that put him in this predicament. You know, I think that he was willing to try anything, they went over there. They were like two kids on this big adventure. You know, and the extraordinary thing about the book is that they actually taped themselves, kind of on a cassette player. We're kind of a travel log of their exploits, and so I was able to transcribe some of that into the book, and it really lends color to really what, you know, what that trip was about.
Yeah, and Jimmy, were you disappointed when Buddy didn't get that miracle he was looking for?
Yeah, it was another disappointment. Actually, we thought he was going to walk. I guess we believed, and what's a little ironic. 2 weeks later, I got in a car accident, and I was in a coma. And so I had a plate in my head, and now I've learned to walk and talk again. And I might have got his miracle, which he thinks.
Oh, interesting. Did he help you when you were recovering?
Oh, yeah. I mean, he tried. He was my man. Yeah, he kept me going. I would look at him and go to a party, maybe out with my friends, and he would be like, "You're going out like that, looking like that?" And I would be like, I'm not going to be stuck in a bed all my life.
Yeah,
One thing I'd like to add about this is Jimmy was a very, very fine baseball player. In fact, he was signed by the Los Angeles Dodgers and really had some terrific talent in his own right. And one of the things I think about this is that after he had his accident, Jimmy, he was uniquely qualified to really understand what Buddy had lost. Among all people, Jimmy could understand how it was to be not the way you once were. So when Buddy came to him with this idea that he wanted to go to Kevorkian, I think Jimmy understood that in some deep level, that, you know, what the pain and the struggle that his brother was going through.
Do you agree with that, Jimmy?
Yeah, I do. But he couldn't get better, and when I had the opportunity to get better, that was hard for me to get better when he couldn't. He was playing a game, I'm out with my friends having fun, and I'm able to get better.
Well, Jimmy definitely had a degree of guilt about the fact that he could get better.
Right.
In fact, he had a degree of guilt about even being down playing with the Dodgers. He said, "I should be home with my brother. I should.
Right.
The hard work's there. I'm out here in the sun.
Getting
you know?
Paid for playing baseball.
Getting paid
and people looking up to me. But I was thinking, wait, what I was doing up in Warminster was harder than baseball.
Oh, that's interesting.
You know, so."
Do you think, Jimmy, and anything that I ask you that you feel uncomfortable with, please don't answer, but do you think Buddy was enjoying your athletic success even if he couldn't have it?
Oh, yes, definitely. Because in high school, when he got hurt, I was in like eighth grade. I quit football. And then when I got to 12th grade, Buddy told me to go out. He wanted me to play football. So I went out for the team. And so he definitely... he knew when I was going to have a good game, too. If I was mad, he goes, "Oh, Jimmy's going to have a good game today." He's mad. He's angry.
Let me just quickly reintroduce the two of you. That's Jimmy Miley joining us by telephone. And we're talking about Buddy Miley, his brother. Buddy was a star quarterback at a high school outside of Philadelphia. In 1973, he was injured playing a game. He was paralyzed, lived at home with his parents. And then in 1997, he went with his brother, Jimmy, to Detroit, where actually Dr. Jack Kevorkian administered drugs that ended Buddy's life. And our guest, Mark Krama writes about all of this in a book called Like Any Normal Day, A Story of Devotion. And Mark Kram is a senior writer at the Philadelphia Daily News. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Jimmy, when Buddy began to talk to you about ending his life, did he also say, and don't tell the rest of the family?
Oh, yeah. It was a quarterback sneak. It was just between me and him. Yeah, we didn't tell anybody. That morning, we told my mom we were going to the eye doctor. So we kept it under wraps.
Was it hard to keep a secret, such a secret, a secret like this from your from your family?
Very hard. Impossible. But I did it, but I don't know how.
Well, do you think it was? Do you think Buddy was afraid that he would be talked out of it?
No, I don't. I think Buddy didn't want to hurt anybody in the family because they weren't for that either. Probably.
So it was a way of protecting the rest of the family. You think?
Yeah. He wanted. Hey, it was the first time he was able to get one of his wishes. You know, he could never go to the date or go here. You know, he couldn't walk, but this is one thing he could do by himself on his own.
Now, Mark's book begins with you and Jimmy and a girlfriend of yours flying out to Detroit and going to this motel. Like a kind of a nondescript motel.
Yes.
Do you remember what that room looked like?
Yeah, it looked like any of the motel room everywhere. Two beds, like a little bathroom, just like a regular old motel with the curtains. And, yeah, I remember going there, and I remember laying on top of them until the doctor came in just so I could be as close as possible.
Yeah, and I hear the emotion in your voice.
Yeah,
and
it's hard.
Of course. It has to be extraordinarily hard. Mark, let me turn back to you. And the doctor they were waiting for was Dr. Kevorkian.
Yes, yes. When Jimmy told me about the events that occurred in the room and how Buddy was cold, his teeth were chattering. So Jimmy went into the room or went over to Buddy and laid on top of him as if he were a blanket, and he laid on top of him for 20 minutes, and it seemed to take forever for Kevorkian to get there. Mm-hmm. Kevorkian said he would get there after dark, and it seemed to take forever for darkness to settle over Michigan. Then there was the tap at the door, and it could only be Dr. Kevorkian. Mm-hmm. And Jimmy leaned down and kissed Buddy on the lips.
Yeah.
And Kevorkian came in and, disappeared into the bathroom with his grim equipment. And then everything speeded up, you know, and then they were gone. Jimmy was asked to leave. Jimmy and Lisa LaPree, his girlfriend, were asked to leave. And Buddy was left there with Kevorkian and his two aides.
And yeah. Jimmy, did Dr. Kevorkian say anything to you?
Well, when he came in, he said to Buddy, "Hey, you're the celebrity, you know." And I do remember distinctly that there was another doctor in the room, and he was telling Buddy, "Buddy, we don't want to do this. So you know, you can change your mind." He said, "I don't want to do it either. I have to do it."
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
So he didn't have any second thoughts about it, any doubts about his decision?
No, he was very stoic. When Dr. Kevorkian was on, I knew Buddy always wanted to go with a heart attack. Huh. But when Kevorkian was on CNN, I sort of called the bluff and said, "Buddy, here, you want to, get in touch with this guy? He does something." And he did the rest. Wow. So I didn't know until that night, if it was he was going to go with it or not, go for it.
In fact, you flew back to Philadelphia and then went to your family. And Mark writes about this, I guess, this meeting that you had with your family after getting back from Detroit. What was that like for you, Jimmy?
Well, the hardest thing when coming back from the motel room, calling my sister.
Yeah.
and telling her we didn't go to the eye doctor. And I remember asking, does everybody hate me? Am I allowed back home? And she said, yeah, we're all at home. Want to give you a hug.
That must have made you feel
some
relief.
Some relief, it did.
And what was it like when you got home?
Well, surreal. Like, I can't believe, you know, everybody was like in shock, I think. Like, what just happened? We were going to the eye doctors, and where's Buddy? So, but I did that not for, you know, the police reasons or the religious reasons. I did it because, just for the heart reasons. But
because that's what your brother wanted?
Because that's what he wanted. Right. That's what he wanted. He couldn't get it, yeah.
Mark,
he didn't want it. He had to do it.
And those were his words.
Yes.
And that's important. Mark, let me go back to you because you do describe this scene, and it's got to be very emotional for Jimmy to relive this of coming home and thinking about his mom, you know, and her reaction. Can you talk about that?
Well, it was...
But it's not as hard as living through it.
Right. It was...
I'm sure.
Living while, you know, taking care of Buddy and him suffering. That was harder than the rest. Yeah.
But there must have been some degree of shock just from the family about what had happened.
Oh, absolutely. Well, actually, there was some sense among some of the other some of Jimmy's siblings that something was going to happen sometime, but they just really didn't have a sense of how it was going to come together. Jimmy's correct; they did keep it under wraps. But he did share his plans with his old high school girlfriend, Karen Kohlmeyer, in Alabama. They had been in close contact for the last 2 years. Buddy, in fact, hired a private investigator to find Karen, and they rekindled a lot of the feelings that they had when they were in high school. But to get back to your point, the shock of, you know, it seemed like this all happened in one day.
Right.
How could something like this happen in one day? In the morning, they're heading off to the eye doctor. By the end of the day, he has come back from Michigan, and Buddy's gone, and their whole world has changed now.
And, Jimmy, we have about 30 seconds before we have to say goodbye to you. And now this is, what, about 15 years since that happened. How do you feel about the decision?
I would do it for him. He would do it for me. I don't have any regrets at all.
And he left notes?
He left notes, yeah. He had to write them with his mouth, and that was before we went, and that was tough. You know, holding the book while he had a pen in his paper, he wrote notes to my mother, my sister, like, thank you, I love you, you know.
Well, Jimmy Miley, it's been a great pleasure, and I so appreciate you joining us today on Radio Times to talk about what obviously was a difficult experience for you and your family, and obviously for your brother, Buddy.
Thanks, Marty.
Thanks very much.
Thanks, Mark.
And we're going to take a very short break, get back to our conversation, continue our conversation, actually, with Mark Cram, talking about his new book, Like Any Normal Day. We'll be right back.
The University of Pennsylvania supports WHYY. Do your drinking habits cause problems in your personal or professional life? Do you drink to cope with stress? These may be signs of alcohol dependence. UPenn is conducting a research study using naltrexone, an FDA-approved medication for use in treating alcoholism. If you are 18 or older, have an alcohol problem, and want to reduce your drinking, you may qualify for the study. Details at 215-222-3200, extension 170. 215-222-3200, extension 170.
I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. We're in the middle of the spring membership campaign here at WHYY, and we will reach our overall goal if you make a pledge of support. You know what you get from Radio Times and all the programs here at WHYY. That's why you listen. Pick up the phone and call 1-888-345-9499. That's 1-888-345-WHYY. You can also pledge online at WHYY.org. Thanks for making that pledge of support. We really appreciate it.
Supporting WHYY Mendelssohn Club of Philadelphia continues its season with Rituals East West at 4 p.m. this Sunday, April 29th at the Church of the Holy Trinity on Rittenhouse Square. This concert features the beautiful Fauré Requiem and a world premiere by Andrea Clearfield. Featured guests include the Pennsylvania Girl Choir and members of the Tibetan community. Tickets and information online at mcchorus.org.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Here's a question for you. If you had a family member that wanted you to help them die, would you do it? That's what Mark Cram writes about in his book called Like Any Normal Day, A Story of Devotion, about Buddy Miley and his brother Jimmy Miley. Jimmy was just with us on Radio Times. You can give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Mark, you actually interviewed Dr. Kevorkian. I don't know if it was the last interview he did, but among, I guess, the last interviews. What was your impression of him?
Well, it was one of the last interviews that I did. He died last June 3rd, and I interviewed him the previous December. We were on the phone for about an hour. He was on the speakerphone in his lawyer's office with a lawyer and his associate, and he was in an extremely dark mood. He didn't remember Buddy, which
I think that tells you a lot.
Which hurt me in a certain way because Buddy was such a memorable guy. You know, how could you forget him? But he had had 130 patients or so, and I got the sense that they were all kind of blurred in his imagination, you know. And I think that, and in a certain sense, although he was sort of fading, his ego was very much intact. And I think that he was trying to deflect attention from Buddy to himself. That was the sense that I got. And, you know, my sense about Kevorkian is that, you know, he served a purpose. His zealotry, the circus act that kind of that became his kind of public stance served its purpose. It drew attention to this issue. But now, a year after his death, I think there's time. It's time to come for have a sober national conversation about an issue that will touch all of us.
Well, and it touches so many deep issues. I mean, for going back to Buddy Miley and even Jimmy Miley, which is that Jimmy had to essentially leave his brother in a motel room with strangers and then go home because he couldn't be there at his bedside while he died.
This is one of the most painful parts of the story for me. And I think it was for Jimmy, too. The idea that, you know, when you have this moment, when you're at the end, you should be surrounded by your loved ones. And you should have that comfort. You shouldn't have to steal away and die under the cover of darkness in some cold room. Mm-hmm. And I think that as a nation, we have to look at this, and we have to really take a sober view of it.
And not to get off on a tangent with Dr. Kevorkian, although it's hard not to, but we pulled up a report from the Detroit Free Press. It goes back a number of years, but it looked at 47 cases of assisted suicide, finding that 60% were not terminal. There were 33 cases of people in pain. Dr. Kevorkian never contacted a psychiatrist or didn't always contact a psychiatrist or even consult with a doctor. There wasn't a minimum waiting period. All the things that he said he would do, he didn't do in all cases.
He had declared war on the establishment, and he was cutting corners. He was one step ahead of the DA. He was moving fast, and Buddy was right in the sweet spot of that of that period for Kevorkian. Buddy was not terminal, but he was he was willing.
Yeah. You mentioned Karen, and this was a woman, from high school that knew Buddy, I guess, on and off through a lot of his life. They had such a what sounds like chemistry. They would come together, go their separate ways, but she seemed to have such a soothing effect on him.
Right. Her voice, I think, had an analgesic effect on him. It soothed his pain. They had met in high school. They were supposed to go out on their first date right after the game that he was injured in. She began going to the hospital and visiting with him every day, and, you know, they fell in love. They were 17 years old, and they and that connection was profound.
Yeah.
It was profound. And when I met Karen, I asked her to help me tap into the heart of the story. And she, in a way that no one else could, helped me understand the inner Buddy, his longing that he had told me about. But she did so at a great cost to herself because, you know, she was in a dilemma. She was married, had children, and yet she felt that she had to be a stalwart for Buddy.
Mm-hmm. Do you think – I mean, did he wanted what everybody wants, obviously, but did he want to marry her?
Yes, I would say so. Mm-hmm. I would say so. But the interesting thing is that had he been able to walk, had it been a normal situation, it's possible that they might have dated for a week and then, or a month and broken up. But they lived within this certain bubble. And for Buddy, Karen became a projection of what a normal life would be, what love was, what a relationship was. And, you know, when Buddy got in touch with her 2 years before his death, he hired a private investigator to, mm-hmm. to find her in a Birmingham hospital.
Where she worked.
Where she worked in the mm-hmm. emergency room under in a married name. And they immediately reconnected. It's like the boy who's you know, at heart, whose heart had touched her, you know, that was still there.
But it sounded like when she was younger, she, in a sense, left him. I mean, she saw that she really couldn't take care of him in the way that he needed to be taken care of. And she goes to, I think it's Texas, and lives in a sense.
No, well, it was Florida.
I think that Buddy...
I don't think it was so much Karen's decision, but I think it was Buddy's decision. Buddy was of the mind at that point that one day something would happen where he'd get up out of that bed and get on the next bus out of town and find Karen and sweep her off her feet. Mm-hmm. And it was pure fantasy, of course. Karen reluctantly went to Florida. You know, and built her own life.
Yeah.
And but then ended up back reemerging 10 years later. And it was like they had this reunion that was so absolutely special to both of them. And then they parted again. And it's just the nature of love sometimes, right?
Absolutely.
The timing is never quite right.
Right.
You know,
but the feelings are there.
But the feelings are there, absolutely. And Karen was an extraordinary help to me in this book, and I'm deeply indebted to her.
What was it like? I mean, I could see the emotion on your face. I mean, what has it been like to write this book and to talk to these people and to think about a young, talented, cocky 17-year-old, you know, high school quarterback whose life is changed.
Well,
in, you know, profound and dramatic ways.
I suppose I identified with Buddy to a certain extent.
Did you?
I mean, well, we were the same age. If you look at pictures of me from high school, I look very much like him. You know, I played sports. You know, so there was these. I identified with him, but to write this book, I had to sort of inhabit his predicament, and no one. Believe me, no one would want to go there because it was a hellish existence that he had. And I have to tell you that even experiencing at the level that I experienced, mm-hmm. what he went through was not a place I would want to go to again.
And it sounded, and totally understandably, that this was extremely stressful on the family, obviously, to have a child to be injured, especially that kind of injury at that time, and to come
home and
to be in that kind of pain, as he describes.
I know. As Rosemary says in her letter to Sports Illustrated, her life with the house was a hell on earth. So what happens when that happens? You do the best that you possibly can. And they did. The Mileys are an extraordinary family. And they pitched in. They did what they could. But it was an impossible situation.
Did you there must be some sense of obligation, because you're writing someone else's story. I mean, to get it right, to use the right words, to have the right sort of tone and atmosphere, because a story like this could go off the rails.
Oh, yes.
It could be, too one way or another, but to find sort of that right tone about it.
Well, it's interesting. I wanted to write a 70,000-word book. I knew exactly how long each chapter was going to be. I turned in a 70,400-word book. I was 400 words over. I missed it just by that much. My point being is that I wanted to I didn't want this story to run off the rails,
right,
to go into a million different places. I wanted to keep the narrative tight, and my hope was that people would be able to read it in two sittings and have a absolutely profound experience that they'll be able to share with their own family members. You don't need to have known Buddy Miley or Jimmy Miley or Karen to get something out of this book. And I hope that people talk to their own family members about it.
Well, I wonder, even in your training as a writer, sports writer, you have deadlines, you have columns. I mean, that you have to learn how to fit a narrative into a very specific space.
Right, absolutely. Well, I don't know if a lot of writers work that way, but I do. I do almost to the word count.
Do you really?
Yeah, it's like, they say good jockeys have a clock in their head where they know where they are at any given point in a race. Well, I did. Mm-hmm. I knew exactly where I was going with this, and it ended up exactly where I wanted to go.
And what was the hardest chapter to write?
Boy.
Or were there several?
Well, there were. The chapters with Karen and Buddy were hard.
Yeah.
Because there was such love that sort of just couldn't come to fruition in those parts. The chapter where Buddy and Jimmy are in the motel room waiting for Kevorkian was especially hard. The pain. These people occupied my thoughts constantly for 2 years. And, it was a profound experience.
And that's Mark Cram Jr., our guest today on Radio Times. He's a senior writer at the Philadelphia Daily News, a longtime sports writer, and author of a new book we've been talking about called Like Any Normal Day, and it's subtitled A Story of Devotion. I'm Marty Moscowane, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY. Let me quote the second paragraph that Rosemary Miley wrote to Sports Illustrated. This goes back to 1993. She also says, the NFL seems to glamorize bone-jarring hits and on-field violence. Instead, shouldn't the league donate some of its profits to aid research into spinal cord injuries? And shouldn't it take strong measures to reduce the occurrence of these on-field injuries? And I thought, that letter could be written today. I know the NFL is trying to do something about this hard hitting on the field, but nonetheless, it's a sport that seems to create a lot of injured players.
Well, we're seeing more and more of it. We're seeing it. Some of the star players of the 70s, 80s, we're now seeing them end up in their 50s and 60s with horrible brain afflictions. Some commit suicide, erratic behavior, depression, anxiety. We're seeing a lot of NFL widows, which is a painful thing to see. I've written some about this for the Daily News to some extent. But my point is that the game really, you know, they can make some rule changes here and there. They can find players for big hits. But the big hits are always going to be there. Mm. And, you know, the interesting thing is that advocates of football have always said that, you know, it's not like boxing, right, where the object is to knock your opponent senseless. That in football, the violence is incidental. Well, it's anything but incidental. In fact, it's the whole point of the game. It's the whole point of the game. You're brought up to get stoked up to put a concussive blow on your opponent. Now, you can pretend that that's not there, but every Sunday and Saturday we see stadiums filled with people to see exactly like that. And a young man like Buddy Miley was being bred into that culture. But we know about Buddy Miley because I wrote a book about him.
Yeah.
But there are many, many, many people scattered across this country who are living in quiet pain and solitude with these same sorts of injuries.
Well, on that note, Mark, thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty.
You're welcome. Mark Cram Jr., we've been talking about his new book called it's called Like Any Normal Day, and it's subtitled A Story of Devotion. He's a senior writer at the Philadelphia Daily News, has been a writer that has covered a lot of sports, and this is certainly a sports story, but it's a much more than that as well. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out much more about this program. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of the show, is produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty McMahon, Dennis Devine, and Debbie Builder. I'm Marty Moscoe. Thank you so much for joining us.